I wanted to bring out to you the fact that this word Messiah, or anointed one, is used in the Old Testament for a king in about half the cases. It's used for the people of Israel in a number of cases. It's used for a priest in four or five cases only. It is used for a prophet in only a couple of cases. But it is used for a king in about half of the cases where it is used. Now here is a commentary, The Prophecy of Daniel by E.J. Young, a commentary which has some very good things in it. Dr. Young has made a very thorough study of the book of Daniel, and wherever he is not prejudiced on a certain point, his material is often of great value. But there are a few points where he has very great prejudices, and in covering a big subject like that, he sometimes jumps to conclusions rather quickly. And here he makes the statement that in the verse to which I referred you in Isaiah, in Daniel 9, where he says Messiah the Prince, he says this must refer to Christ, must be a prediction of Christ, because he is the only one who was both a king and a priest. Well, now Messiah the Prince, the word prince suggests it's referring to a king. But does Messiah mean it's referring to a priest? Well, you have gathered your own evidence by looking at the use of the word in the Hebrew, or in the Old Testament. That Hebrew word is translated anointed in most cases, and in half the cases it is used of a king. So Messiah the Prince might be one who is a king and a priest, but it doesn't have to be. It's simply one whom God has set apart for a certain important task. So in that verse, whether it is talking about Christ or not is a matter to be decided on other grounds and not simply to be decided by the fact that the King James Version used this particular word or by such an argument as this one, which unfortunately Dr. Young gave, which as you see when you look at the original is quite out of place. Well now, so much for that assignment. Maybe I should mention now that the next assignment deals with those same verses in chapter 9. A brief passage which has had a tremendous amount of discussion in the Christian world. And it only relates to one verse in it. And it is quite a simple thing which you can probably do in a very few minutes, but it takes longer to explain what it is. And therefore I have posted the three copies of the assignment on the board. And I believe once you read it, you will have practically all of it in mind. You won't need to copy more than a tiny part of what is on the board. But I posted three copies, and I'll take two of them down after today, because I don't want to take up that much of the board, of course. Now, we are looking now at Daniel 11. And the last two lectures, we spent quite a bit of time on Daniel 11. I've been sorry to note a couple who have missed those two lectures. And I would suggest, Mr. Nair tells me that he has been turning over cassettes of the lectures to the library. And you could borrow those cassettes and listen to them if you would like. And anyone who has question about any of the matters that were discussed in the test, I went through it rather carefully 2 weeks ago, those questions, and they are on the cassette of that lecture. But on Daniel 9, as we have noticed, Daniel 11, as we have noticed, it contains a great many statements which would be very difficult to interpret in advance. But statements which, when the events occurred, some of them you can say, well, this fits, but it could fit with a dozen other things. But other statements which very specifically fit. And we noticed in chapter 11 how it starts with verse 2 and refers to the fact that there will be yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth will be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he will stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And you would not know exactly what's going to happen if you lived in Daniel's day from this verse. You could form a pretty good guess that there would be three more kings of Persia, and then a fourth one who would be richer than any of the previous ones, as Xerxes was, and that he would make a great attack on Greece. And it was the greatest attack that perhaps has ever been made on Greece. Perhaps one of the greatest attacks in all history was that tremendous army which he turned against Greece and made such an impression on the Greeks from there, managing to survive that attack, that it was very important in all their thinking for 200 years later, and they were psychologically prepared for Alexander the Great to go back and attack the Persian Empire and destroy it. And then in the third verse, we notice, a mighty king will stand up and rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And of course, this could be said of many different people. But the following verse speaks specifically about Alexander the Great, so we know that verse 3 here was a description of Alexander the Great, the mightiest king the world had perhaps yet seen up to that time, who nothing seemed to be able to stand before. But you notice between verses 2 and 3, there is an unmentioned interval of over 150 years. He simply passes from Xerxes, who attacked Greece, to Alexander the Great, who destroyed the Persian Empire. Skips over 150 years without any reference to it. Then in verse 4, it tells about the division of Alexander's empire. And in advance, it might be hard to know what's meant. His kingdom will be broken. When he stands up, his kingdom will be broken. In other words, he didn't have his power very long. And he was just a young fellow in his early 30s when he rather suddenly died. And his kingdom was broken. They tried to keep it together, but they soon got to fighting, and pretty soon it was divided into three large important sections and a few smaller sections. So it was divided not according to the dominion of which he ruled and not according to his posterity within the next 15 years. Every relative of Alexander, his mother, his brothers, his children, every relative of his was killed. It was not according to his posterity or according to his dominion which he ruled. It was given to others. And then verse 5 says, the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his generals, who took the most southern part of it, Ptolemy, who took Egypt, was a very strong king. You couldn't predict exactly what this would be in the future, but when it came to pass, you'd say, well, isn't this wonderful that Daniel predicted this 300 years in advance? Tremendous. One of his princes shall be, the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. And then when you find one of Ptolemy's generals going up and getting control of the whole eastern half of the Persian Empire, that certainly is a remarkable fulfillment of this. You wouldn't know in advance just what was going to happen, but when it happened, you would see how tremendously accurately Daniel had predicted this. He shall be strong above him. He had a far wider area than Ptolemy had, and have dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion. And then verse 6, in the end of years they will join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Here between verses 5 and 6, you skip over Seleucus' son. You skip to his grandson. So there is an unmentioned interval of about 30 years there. And then you find an attempt to bring the two together. And they make an agreement. The king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Well, in the treaty, as you know, Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, was married to Antiochus II. But she shall not retain the power of her arm, neither shall he stand or his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. And we took time to notice how conflict between Bernice and Laodice, the former wife, and how in the end Bernice and her child were killed and her father died at about the same time, and the man who had married her was thought to have been poisoned by his first wife. Very exact fulfillment of this. You might not know exactly how it would be, but when it happened, you'd say, how wonderful that Daniel could predict these details. And verse 7, but out of a branch of her root shall one stand up. One descended from her ancestors, a rather poetic way to describe her brother, who came up with his army and attacked. And the next two verses we have his tremendous victory over the next king. And then in verse 10, referring on to the king of the north, his son shall be stirred up and assemble a great multitude. And their fighting goes on through two or three verses. Then you have the account of Antiochus III, as we noticed. And we went through the details of his conquering Palestine, specifically referred to here, the people in Israel who tried to help him to get away from the Ptolemies in order to establish the vision, their idea of being better off, which proved not to work, and the mention of his conflict with Rome. And then in verse 20, we had his son, there shall stand in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. It'd be hard to tell what it's going to be, but when it happened, we saw that Antiochus III had to pay such tremendous reparations to Rome that it was necessary that his son devote himself to trying to reestablish fiscal stability in the kingdom, and spent most of his time raising taxes and making up for the great expenses of his father. Mr. Montague? Yes. Yeah. So Lucas 4, either he raised the taxes or he sent someone to raise the taxes. It could be taken either of the two ways. But his principal activity was in reestablishing fiscal stability. And then verses 21 following, we noticed that in verses 21 on, we have the account of Antiochus Epiphanes. At the end of the last hour, we discussed his career. I won't want to go over details of it much now again. I looked a couple of days ago at the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. As you may know, it was completely rewritten just a few years ago with an entirely different plan. And I looked up the article. Most in the previous issues, they continue articles on and on and on. You don't know if you get an Encyclopedia Britannica of 10 years ago, you don't know whether an article in it was written that year or 15 years before, because they were just making little changes all the time. But this is a complete change. And so I was interested to see what they'd say about Antiochus IV. And they said that Antiochus IV was a very able king, a very effective king, an able fighter, and quite inadvertently he gave occasion for the establishment of an independent Jewish state, which is quite a modernistic way of saying that he tried to destroy the Jewish religion, that he took over the temple in Jerusalem, established the worship of the Greek gods there, killed Jews who would not sacrifice to idols, and made things so terrible that the Maccabean uprising developed, and an independent Jewish state lasted for the next century. It's easy to see what is the bias of the man who wrote that particular article about Antiochus. But the interesting thing is that in the beginning of the article, he said Antiochus IV Epiphanes, also called Epimenes. And that's the only detrimental word really he said about him in the article. And unless you know Greek, it will not convey any meaning to you. And he called himself Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, which means Antiochus the outshining god. Now all the Seleucid kings before this and the Ptolemies also called themselves gods. But he was the first one to put it on his coins. He put the word Epiphanes. He was the outshining god, the Epiphanes. But his people, seeing his crazy antics, as we noticed, he would steal from the temples and then he'd go around just throwing money around. He would kill somebody at a just a crazy impulse, and then he'd take some other poor person and lift him up and give him lots of honors. And he was very erratic in many ways. And so the people, instead of calling him, when he wasn't around, Epiphanes, the outshining god, called him Epimenes, the mad one. And this article is funny how they just say, also called Epimenes, and everything else they say about him is very favorable. But the account of him that is given here is not particularly favorable, as you can expect, when he tried to destroy all knowledge of God and put a complete end to the Old Testament religion. Well, we saw various aspects of his life last time, and noticed how they were carried out. And so we want to go on from 2 to 3, what the Bible tells about it. Number 3, the outline of Daniel 11, 21 to 12, 3. Now, I've put some other figures at the right in red, and you don't need to worry too much about them quite yet. I'll explain their meaning later. We read about his character in verses 21 to 24. And in 36 to 39, we have another description of character of a king. In verses 25 to the end of the first half of 30, we read a general account of his political activities. And we have an account of the political activities of the king in verses 40 to 45. And we read about the trouble and relief for God's people in the last part of verse 30 through 35. And in verses 1 to 3 of the next chapter, which continues right on, as you know, 10 to 12 is one continuous thing, we have there what could be described as trouble and relief for God's people. So you go through three subjects about Antiochus, and then you again go through three subjects about a king. And of course, according to the critical view, you are dealing with the same man, and you've told these things about him, and then you go through it over again in different words, is their view. But it doesn't work out. So I've just incidentally mentioned those figures here. We speak about them later. But we go on to briefly mention specific points of clear fulfillment. There are remarks made about him, as about other rulers that could be made about anybody, and or any great conqueror and so on. We won't concern ourselves particularly with them. They fit him, so they are a proper part of the prophecy. But we note specific matters, such as in verses 21 to 23, we find that he was not the legitimate ruler. We find that he came in by an unusual arrangement. Verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person. Vile in Old English doesn't mean necessarily a wicked person. It may mean a person of unworthy standing. A person who did not have the right to take what he got. And in this case, Seleucus IV's son, who was a hostage in Rome, was the one who was, according to the laws, entitled to come over and become his successor. But before he could come, while the man who had killed Seleucus was trying to establish himself as ruler in the name of Seleucus's infant child, while that was being done, Antiochus IV managed to come in and kill the man who had killed his brother and the child also, and establish himself as king. So in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably. Peaceably here, he did not make a conquest. He got the king of a neighboring area to lend him some money and help him to get there with a small force, and then came in and declared he was the son of Antiochus the Great and killed the murderer and took power before people realized what was happening. And he took over the power, obtained the kingdom by flatteries, and he became strong with a few people. He worked deceitfully. These three verses tell about his accession and exactly fit his and would not have fit any of the kings we've looked at before. Then we find in verse 24 the strange contrast in his character. He entered peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. This word peaceably here has more the idea of without, by stealth. It is by taking something without people realizing what is happening. He would get a hold of things and get into the temples and seize their treasures. He did that not only with the temple of Jerusalem, but with temples of various gods. He raised very large exactions from people that had a considerable amount of money, and then he would scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. There's a man who made seizures and also squandered the money that he got. Typical of his character, and he's not the only man who ever had such a contrast, but it is not rare. I mean, it is not common. Then we have his attack on Egypt, verses 25 following. Of course, many of these Seleucid kings made attacks on Egypt. But here we find that the treasury of Pharaoh's supporters in verses 25 to 26, those who were supposed to be helping the Antiochus' nephew, the legitimate king of Egypt, but he was a young boy, and they conspired against him. And then we find verse 27, where he told his nephew he was going to help him. The two kings sat at one table telling lies, each of them making the other think he'd stand with him and really being against him. And then first part of verse 28, his return to Antioch with great wealth, but on the way back, his heart was against the Holy Covenant, and he did, the word exploits inserted in the King James, he did things at Jerusalem there and returned to his own land. He tried to rob the temple. He gave strict orders that the Jews were not to be circumcised, that they were not to follow the Mosaic law. And he returned to Antioch with great wealth, but returned to Jerusalem unrighteous. We have these matters predicted in such a way that you would not know very much exactly what was going to happen, but that when it did happen, you could see that it was indeed exactly fulfilled. Now, just down on the right-hand side of this paper, I have put further of this, his second invasion of Egypt. You find in verse 29 following, which we looked at last time. I mentioned Popilius Linus here. You remember how he, the Roman emissary, came and told him to withdraw from Egypt when he was about to have it all in his hands. And he said, I'll require consideration. And he drew a line around him in the sand and said, you can consider it as long as you stay in that circle. And he gave in to the Romans, but he was very, very much irritated by it, naturally. And when he returned, he took it out on the Jews. And so we have in verse 30 the reference to the ships of Kittim come against him. Kittim is a word regularly used in the Old Testament for the regions to the west in the Mediterranean. And therefore he's grieved and returns and has indignation against the Holy Covenant. And that was his reaction to it, was partly to hold his great games in Antioch, to which he invited people from all over the then known world and spent tremendous sums of money. But the other part of it was to try to unify the religion of his empire by destroying all who would not worship Zeus. And it was now that his army seized the temple in Jerusalem and so polluted it that no pious Jew could possibly go into it again until it had been purged and cleansed. So we have his severe persecution of Judaism described in verse 30, the second part. And so shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Verse 31, they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength and take away the daily sacrifice and place the abomination that makes desolate. And when they put up the statue of Zeus right in the temple of the Lord there in Jerusalem, it made the place so desolate in the eyes of any pious Jew that he couldn't think of going into it. And so verse 32 then tells about the beginning of the Maccabean revolt, 32 to 35. The people, some of them rose up against him, and then they succeeded a little bit, and others joined with them that weren't really thoroughly with them. And in the end, while the Maccabean revolt did free Judea and made it an independent kingdom for about nearly a century, yet there was the leadership of it was quite mixed. Yes? Now we will later this hour. Thank you. A very important question. Very important question. If somebody were to tell you back in 1750, if somebody made a prediction, there will be a great ruler in who will rise up in one of the countries of Europe, and he will lead armies making rapid marches across most of Europe and conquer many countries and take great wealth, but he will be completely defeated and his regime utterly destroyed. Well, you could say that was exactly fulfilled in Napoleon. But then again, you could find it was exactly fulfilled in Hitler. Well, it may be fulfilled in somebody else yet. Who can say? But I would say it would have to be one or the other. It would be a prediction of Napoleon, or if it didn't fit with Napoleon, you'd say it has still to come its fulfillment, and you would find it in Hitler. Now somebody could say, well, Napoleon was just a type of Hitler. Napoleon was merely a symbol of what Hitler would be like. Well, if you're going to say that, then maybe Hitler is just a symbol of somebody's coming 20 years from now. It seems to me that there's great danger in that sort of thing. Now, there are cases where the Scripture sees two things that are related, that are similar, and there's a sort of a composite picture. But that is rare, and I would say go very slow about accepting any such thing. If you find a definite fulfillment of something, I would say it is complete. When it says ships of Chittim will come against him, that might refer to the American ships going during the last war and putting an end to Hitler's regime, ships from the West coming. But I don't think it does. I think it was fulfilled in Popilius Lenius. And my feeling is that in almost every case, when something is predicted, you look for one fulfillment. Now, of course, there are two exceptions that should be mentioned. One is, if you say there will be great conquerors who will conquer many countries, that could include both Napoleon and Hitler, because you've used the plural term. Or there can be a succession. They ask Moses, what shall we do? How will we know the Lord's will after you're gone? He says, God will raise up a prophet like unto me. Him shall you hear. And after Moses was gone, God raised up a succession of prophets. How are we going to know God's will when you're gone, Moses? Well, look to God to raise up a prophet. And God raised up one prophet after another, and as time went on, the Jews understood that this succession of prophets that was predicted would have its culmination in the greatest of all the prophets. And so they came to Jesus in John 1 and said, John the Baptist rather said, are you that prophet? Are you the one, the great climax of the succession of prophets? But in general, I say, look for one fulfillment of any statement that is given in the Scripture. That's a little aside, but it relates to our whole subject to quite an extent. So I thank you for the question. But we do want to get on with this. We have then these very remarkable fulfillments of the history tracing through right up telling about Antiochus III, at length telling exactly about his son, Seleucus IV, and then telling about the other son, Antiochus IV, with a considerable length. We have all these things which, when the events occurred, you could see how it fit. But you would not know a great deal in advance of the details of God's plan. Well, so much for Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, number 5 is Daniel 11:36 to 12:3. And as I pointed out to you a few minutes ago, Daniel 5, that's number 5, Daniel 11:36 to 12:3. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we have, as I gave under number 3 here, the character and accession of Antiochus Epiphanes, verses 21 to 24. Now we go back again to the description of a character of a king, in verse 36 and following. We have Antiochus' political activities in verses 25 to the first part of 30, and we have the political activities of a king again given in 40 to 45. We have trouble and relief for God's people in 30c to 35, and in verses 1 to 3 of the next chapter, we have a section that could very well be called trouble and relief for God's people. Now, of course, the holders of the critical view insist that verse 36 on is still talking about Antiochus IV. We are still knowing about him. It is strange, but not impossible, that you go back and tell all over again about his character after you've told these other things. It is strange, but not impossible, that having told so much about his career, you go back and tell again about his career or about additional events in his career. And that having told a little about trouble and relief for God's people, you again go into it. That is not at all impossible. But it doesn't fit. Most of what is said here has no precise fulfillment in Antiochus Epiphanes. And so the critics are in great difficulty when they try to say it's still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And so we have the question, if it is not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, who is it talking about? And this commentary by Edwin J. Young, to which I referred a few minutes ago, speaks of this section and says that there have been many interpretations of it. And he says the following are the principal interpretations. Number one, Antiochus Epiphanes. Number two, Constantine the Great. Number three, Omar, the Islamic Caliph. Number four, the Roman Empire. And then he says, number five, the dispensationalist interpretations. Number six, the Pope of Rome and the Papal System. Number seven, Herod the Great. And number eight, the Antichrist. And number eight is the one he insists is the correct one. He says, the Antichrist, this may be called the traditional interpretation in the Christian church. It was advocated by St. Jerome at about 400 A.D., and in this he has been followed by many. Now, the term Antichrist is not a particularly good term to you. John says, there are many Antichrists. Antichrist is a very general term. But there is a specific person referred to in 2 Thessalonians where Paul says that there is one of whom Isaiah said that the Lord will destroy him at his coming. One who, it is said, will sit in the temple of God giving forth that he is a God and should be worshipped. One who, Paul describes the terrible things that he is to do just before the return of Christ. And it is quite common for us to refer to this one as the Antichrist. And you notice that Young does that. He calls him the Antichrist. I see no harm in that usage, so long as we remember that it is not a scriptural practice. The scripture uses the term Antichrist in a more general way for all great enemies of the Lord's work. But you notice the strange thing about Dr. Young's commentary, as I mentioned. He is very good on many of his treatments, has much that is excellent in the commentary, but he has a strong prejudice against what he calls dispensationalism. And if anybody who he calls a dispensationalist holds a view, that's almost enough in his mind to condemn the view. And so we notice here on page 246 of his commentary that as the fifth, he gives the dispensationalist interpretations, which of course are wrong, as all the first seven are here. And then the eighth he gives, the Antichrist. Now, he gives two dispensationalist interpretations. He says, A, the king, verse 36, is the little horn of Daniel 7, who is an apostate, not from Judaism, but from Christianity. He establishes his palace in Jerusalem, from which time runs the great tribulation, the last 3.5 years of Daniel's 70th week. Well, now that would certainly be the one who would be called the Antichrist, wouldn't it? He doesn't use the term Antichrist there. He says he's the little horn of Daniel 7, who's an apostate not from Judaism but from Christianity. The other so-called dispensationalist interpretation he gives is, B, he is the Antichrist, not to be identified either with the little horn of chapter 7 or with that of chapter 8. This willful king will be a Jew who in the midst of Jewish people will assume kingly honors, being recognized by the Jewish apostates as the Messiah king and by the Christian apostates as the Antichrist. In the middle of the 70th week, he will come and take his seat in the Jerusalem temple and will claim divine worship. The only difference between these two interpretations, as he calls it, is that one says the man is an apostate from Christianity and the other says he's a Jew. But they both agree that he is a man who can be called Antichrist because he is the great enemy of God at the end of this age. And then his eighth interpretation is that it is the Antichrist, and that is the one he says is right. And so I would think it better if he subsumed what he calls the two dispensationalist interpretations under his and say he's either a Jew or a Christian, but in either case he's the Antichrist. Mr. Brown?
Yes, sir. The time correction is really not enough. He's trying to disassociate a monocle of what the Jews by some of the nation wants to use the church fathers to substantiate their viewpoint on this.
Well, he doesn't mention a church father here under number 5. But he says one dispensationalist view is that he's the Antichrist who's a Jew, the other is that he's the Antichrist who is a Gentile, and the correct view is that he is the Antichrist. But I believe that most Christian interpreters have held that these verses are a description of the Antichrist. And a very interesting thing, though, in addition to that, about Dr. Young's commentary, is that in chapters 2 and chapter 7 and chapter 9, he is very much against the idea of an unmentioned interval between two great events. But here, he assumes a jump of at least 2,000 years without it being mentioned between verse 35 and 36. And of course, we have to assume that, or else to say that 36 to 39 is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And there is statement after statement in this section that just doesn't fit Antiochus Epiphanes. And statements about things that he would do that we have no historical evidence of his doing. One, for instance, is it describes an expedition against Egypt, which is very successful. Now, some who hold a critical view will say this is a repetition of what's already been said, that he'll make an expedition against Egypt. Others say this describes a third expedition against Egypt, which is not mentioned in any of our histories. Well, it seems it would be a little strange if at that period he made a third expedition which wasn't mentioned in any of our histories. And it would be particularly strange since his second expedition was brought to an end when the Romans ordered him to go back, and that was sufficient to lead him to go back. If he'd made a third expedition under those circumstances, we can be sure the Romans would have come with power, and it certainly would have made enough stir that there'd be some mention of it in history. Young, without saying so, assumes an unmentioned interval of at least 2,000 years at this point between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Antichrist. And you notice that the section ends with the resurrection. Verse 2 of chapter 12, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. There is the resurrection there with which it ends. And according to the critical view, this is the vain hope of someone in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes who wrote the book of Daniel. But if you take it as a true message from God, it runs to the resurrection. So even if there were not this unmentioned interval between Antiochus and Antichrist, if some of this continued to be about Antiochus, there'd have to be that unmentioned interval somewhere, because you get to the resurrection right then. Now, I don't know how much time we ought to take at looking at points in this that were not fulfilled in Antiochus. But let us look quickly at verses 36 to 38, 39, where it speaks about his character. You notice in 36 it says, he shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. Antiochus died while his persecution was still in progress. He did not prosper till it was accomplished. Verse 37, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. Antiochus built great temples to the pagan gods and put up monuments to them here and there. Those who hold the critical view, some of them try to get around this by saying his ancestors worshipped Apollo and he worshipped Zeus. But Apollo was the son of Zeus. Anyone who worshipped Apollo also worshipped Zeus. It is not a satisfactory interpretation. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. That's what suggests what Young referred to, that he is an apostate from Judaism, or that he is someone with a Christian background who has turned away from it. But it certainly doesn't fit anything in the life of Antiochus. Nor the desire of women. It is not quite clear what that means. He shall not regard the desire of women. Some have said that he destroyed a licentious religious cult in Syria, which could be called the desire of women. But there's no evidence of his ever doing any such thing, and it doesn't fit with his general attitude toward paganism. Nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He built a tremendous temple to Zeus in Athens, in addition to the great temples he built in Palestine and Syria. Verse 38, but in his estate shall he honor the god of forces. And no one in ancient times could even guess what that would mean. He will honor the god of forces. And so the Greek word maozim, Jerome simply took as a personal god. He will honor the god maozim. But we don't know anything about any god maozim. But the god of fortresses he will honor. What is that? A god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god. To people in ancient times, this would make no meaning whatever. Because all ancient rulers worshiped some god. But in our day, it is quite common to find those. In fact, a third of the world is held in the hands today of those who say there is no god except the god of power. And they say that when, was it Winston Churchill suggested to Stalin that at a peace conference they should have a representative of the Pope? And Stalin said, how many divisions does he control? In other words, Stalin was interested in how big an army you had only, not in any spiritual force. And that, of course, is the attitude of the communists. They've completely wiped out religion, at least outwardly, from China. No one is allowed to have any outward manifestation of any religion in China and in Russia. While it is not legally ruled out, it is in actual practice tremendously persecuted. And a part of the belief of those who now hold a third of the world in their power and the belief of a great many leaders in other countries is materialism, the god of forces, the god of fortresses. That's the god that they honor. And so this would be a very good description of what the character of Antichrist will be, very different from the character of Antiochus. And we will not take time to go on through further with these verses. There are specific things said in them for which we find nothing comparing in the life of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so there would seem to be a definite jump, an unmentioned interval, between verse 35 and 36. And here from 36 to 12:3, a description of events to occur at the very end of the present age, just before the return of Christ. Well, we continue there next time.